night lodges. I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 506 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show takes a look at how school undermines children's ability to care for one another in the service of preparing them for a life of wage slavery. In the second hour, we're going to listen to some research findings about what really motivates people and what happens to their behavior if you take the cynical economist's view that people don't care about others, that they are lazy, greedy, and have to be motivated through money, otherwise they won't work for others. We're going to feature a clip from The Trap about the use of targets, as well as a couple of other speakers reporting their research into what really motivates people. Last week we heard George Lakoff's presentation, in which he contrasted strict father morality and nurturing parent morality. One of the duties of the nurturing parent is to teach their children to be nurturers in turn. So how do you think you would go about teaching children to be nurturers of others? Would you punish them if you found that they weren't nurturing the way that you liked? Would you reward them if you thought they were behaving properly? The first hour, we have a presentation from Alfie Cohn about teaching children to care. In it, he suggests that rewarding good behavior and punishing bad behavior tends to undermine children's nurturing capacity. Why? Because it encourages children to think about the rewards or the punishments, that is, to think about what they can get out of it themselves, not about the person whom they could be nurturing. By taking a pessimistic view of human nature, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and a generation of children is raised who are selfish. In the same way, the economist's assumption, homo economicus, of human nature becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I've done what I can to clean up Alfie Cohn's recording, but the first few minutes the sound quality was really not good, so instead I'm going to just summarize what he talks about. He describes two pieces of research into the effects of praising good behavior and punishing bad behavior, and it seems to be counterproductive in both cases. And the very worst cases is when you praise children for nurturing others, when you punish them for being inconsiderate of others. The research findings are that this strengthens the bad behavior that the discipline claims that it tackles. One of his main points is the difference between behavior and motivation. If kids are disciplined into behaving, then once the discipline is removed, then that behavior is likely to change. He also talks about children who have effectively internalized that discipline, but who don't really believe that what they're doing is the right thing, and suggest that they are not nurturers in the true sense. In spite of a large number of good-hearted teachers inside the school institution, school is of course not intended to prepare children to be nurturers of others. As pointed out by John Taylor Gatto and others, it's intended to prepare children to be willing wage slaves, and that entails breaking their spirit to the extent that they are easy to motivate externally. So they need to be broken of the habit of following their heart's guidance. They need to be taught to work for money and not for love. Arguably, I think that's probably the most important and the most damaging lesson that school teaches. Now here's Alfie Cohn on teaching children to care.
I'm looking for kids who have an enduring commitment to addressing the needs of other people, helping and sharing. One that is not merely present when they think they're going to get something out of it, whether it's a tangible response or even a good job from one of us. I'm not really looking for kids who help merely in a self-interested way. That's why, with little children, for example, about the last thing we want to say to them is, now, Janine, if you let Roger play with your truck, I'll bet he'll let you play with his big wheel. That doesn't promote caring. That promotes self-regarding shrewdness. We can aim higher than mere reciprocity. I want kids to take pleasure from helping, but also to be committed to helping even when there is no benefit for them. In other words, I want kids to be altruistic. That word is sometimes defined in the farther reaches of human capability, so you have to be Mother Teresa to be called an altruist. You have to dive into a frozen pond, which hurts. All right, a near-frozen pond. To rescue a drowning child can be an altruist. It's kind of interesting. We don't have those same lofty, extreme characteristics built into our definition of what it means to be aggressive. You don't have to kill lots of people to be aggressive. But you have to be extraordinarily self-sacrificing to be altruistic. I use a different definition. For me, altruism is simply helping other people because they need the help. Not merely, for example, because you think you're going to get some recognition or be helped later by those people. So I want them to help even when they don't benefit. I want kids to have a generalized pro-social orientation. Not just helping people they like or look like. I want widening circles of care, reaching out beyond their friends and relatives, beyond those in their class or school, beyond those in their town or province, and above all, as it becomes increasingly vital, beyond their own country, to understand the human connections and the ways in which we are committed to other human beings. Implicit in all of this is that motives matter, not just behavior. I told some of you last night in my talk for parents that you can judge how valuable a book or article or a seminar is for teachers or parents by how few times the word behavior is used. Because the more we talk about what we do with kids' behavior, the more stuck we are on the surface with just the stuff that's visible and measurable, overlooking the motives and values and reasons, and the kids themselves who engage in the behaviors. No wonder people who focus mostly on children's behaviors tend to do stuff like rewards and punishments to make some behaviors appear and others disappear. And the long-term effect is at best minimal. At worst, we end up with kids who are less committed in their hearts to helping other people because we have tried to bribe and threaten them into acting in a particular way when they think they can get the reward or avoid the punishment. The more focused we are on whole children, the more focused we are on their disposition to care, the less likely we are to talk about what we're going to do about kids' behavior. One more radical premise follows from this. We are not just interested in having kids who are self-disciplined. We are not just interested in kids who help in the absence of an adult standing over them, because that might be a small step beyond doing it just for the reward or punishment they can get today. But some kids have introjected or swallowed those values such that they're now being controlled by us through remote control without having really integrated a commitment to the well-being of others. Some of those kids are like that academically too. There are actually parents and teachers who are pleased to find older kids who work and work and work at academics, even without somebody standing in front of them with a carrot or behind them with a stick. But some of those kids are joyless. They are workaholics in training. They are internally motivated, but not intrinsically motivated. And that's a very important distinction. The same applies to caring as it does to learning. Now, having put my cards on the table in terms of what I'm looking for in the long run, I must confess that while everybody says, sure, we want caring kids, the pursuit of care is not as uncontroversial as it may seem. Some people object to this stuff. Here are the objections that you might hear, even if you yourself don't offer them, and you should know how to respond. Number one, that's teaching values. You can't do that, or at least you shouldn't be doing that in a public school system. My response, we're always teaching values. Even if we do nothing explicitly addressed to generosity, care, or social development, we're not introducing values into a neutral environment. The question is, which values do we want to teach and how? There are always values there. If only one person in the room, in a classroom, is called by her last name, there's a value there. Who decided what went on the wall of the classroom? Values are present. And so it goes. Is this a place that's mostly about FSA scores or about something else? Values are always present. We should never deceive ourselves into thinking that because they're invisible, they're inconsequential. Or just because the values happen to be shared by most people in our society doesn't mean it's a value-neutral environment. The second part of this is, people say values should be taught at home. I don't know anybody who disagrees with that. But of course, it's not always done, at least in terms of the values many of us celebrate, let's be honest. Plus, if it is done, that's a very desirable form of redundancy. I guess I'd put it this way. If being committed to helping other people, to being compassionate, responsible, honest, courageous selves, already being done by parents in the home, that makes our job as educators easier. If those values are not being taught at home, it makes our jobs more important. In either case, I don't think we can allow ourselves to be put on the defensive because this is a conference about values and that's our obligation and that's our agenda. Number two, closely related to that, is the idea that we ought to be using the schools primarily for academics. But in fact, there is a growing mandate in North America for schools, too, to be pursuing something beyond academics. You would know it by your government or mine. A Gallup poll a few years ago asked parents, which should public schools emphasize most? Academic skills, the ability to work with others, or the ability to take responsibility? The latter two, the non-academic ones, won the endorsement of 59% of the parents who were asked, academics 39%. These days, we face horrific events in Virginia, the astonishing, the horrifying mass slaying. We are just now, I think today or yesterday, by an odd and sad coincidence, marking the Columbine, Colorado mass slaying anniversary as well. And you folks in Canada are not immune to this, sad to say, even in BC. You know, we don't have to point to extraordinary events like shootings to suggest that schools need to be places to help kids become better people, not just better learners. We don't need these dramatic violent events. All we have to look at is the number of kids who are graduating thinking that their job is to look out for number one. The number of kids who at a tender age learn not to be tender. And we begin to recognize how important it is. But when people say don't forget academics, my response is I don't. The good news is not mutually exclusive. Some of the same policies and practices that can help kids develop socially and morally also can help them develop intellectually. When you have a class meeting for kids to solve problems and make decisions together, they are often acknowledging intellectual difficulties and problem solving at the same time that they're forming a community and helping to grow in an ethical sense. Cooperative or collaborative learning, where kids are in pairs or small groups, as I think they should be most of the time in a classroom setting, end up learning more effectively, according to research, but at the same time, deriving other non-academic benefits as well. So when we look at the objections, we tend to find that they don't end up needing to deflect us from an important mission. The last of these is that it's futile. Not many people will say it that way. But a lot of folks, whether they put it explicitly or not, don't believe we can make that much difference to really help kids become concerned about others. Give them an inch, they'll take a mile, is one of many expressions in the folk wisdom based on the idea that there's something intrinsically wrong with kids, and by extension, our species. The reality I've learned is that give them an inch, they'll take a mile is generally true of kids who have only been given inches in their lives. In other words, when they're over-controlled, they tend to take advantage, and the last thing they need now is still more control, tighter regulation, tougher consequences, and less trust, which is exactly how we tend to respond so typically. We need to look at what the research actually says about human nature. I wrote a book about this in 1990 called The Brighter Side of Human Nature, a book that I don't mind telling you has sold dozens of copies. And in the book, I reviewed evidence. And it's really quite striking. I don't know if you're familiar with this stuff. Three different studies found that newborn infants, hours old, tend to cry louder in response to other infant cries than in response to equally loud and sudden noises, suggesting, as the researchers themselves put it, that we're born with a primitive precursor to empathy, an inclination innately to be distressed by other people's distress. Other research found in the 1970s that toddlers are often inclined to help in whatever way they can. Someone who feels bad to feel better in many cases. And then a third batch of research followed preschoolers around, noticing that they tended to help quite a bit. One researcher, Nancy Eisenberg, wanted to know why little kids tended to help a lot, to share, to care, and she came up with a technique for discovering their motivation that no researcher before 1979 had ever used. She asked them. And they did not respond the way they were supposed to have based on developmental theory. Apparently these little four-year-olds hadn't read Kohlberg, so they didn't know that they were supposed to say, I only help so that I'll avoid being punished, or so the teacher will like me, or so I'll get a cookie tomorrow from the kid I gave one to today. They tended to respond to the question, why did you give him a cookie, in a tone often suggesting the questioner is not very swift, by saying, because he was hungry. That meets my definition of altruism, not merely pro-social behavior. There's a lot of this stuff. But when we assume the worst about kids, about human nature, about children, about this child, or about what this child did at 10:30 this morning, we tend to have kids live down to our expectations and become exactly as aggressive and obnoxious and competitive and selfish as we believed they were. But when we assume better motives, when we take at least a neutral position, if not a more positive one, we create what I like to call an auspicious circle instead of a vicious circle, where kids often live up to our expectations. So much for the objections and the definitions. What can we do? Here are some suggestions that are more positive, and then I will get to the more controversial negative ones that are equally important, I believe. Positively speaking, what helps kids to be caring people? First, we set an example. We model. We admit when we've made a mistake. We apologize to kids when we may have hurt their feelings. We are not Dr. Spock. We are not Mr. Spock, I guess, more to the point, in terms of being purely rational creatures. But the fact that kids can make us upset is something we're honest about. We're not a machine. We model helping for them, and yet we're careful not to help so much that kids learn that whenever there's a problem, the grown-up will take care of it. That's an interesting balance to walk. We also model acceptance of helping. There are some people in our society who have grave difficulties acknowledging that they need assistance. We have a word for these people. Men. And we are aware that we are always modeling. It's not just when we're self-consciously setting an example. 2 minutes ago, when you weren't thinking about it, kids were watching you then as well. Number four. Lately, I've come to think of modeling as having a twist to it. That merely setting an example is not sufficient. We also have to explain and account for what we are doing. I'm starting to call this deep modeling, which is where we take kids backstage, so to speak, to give them access to what went on behind our behavior, because modeling is really a behaviorist concept when you think about it, to help them understand how we wrestle with ethical issues. And the hard ethical problems, most of the ones we face in life, are not between choosing good versus bad. They're between two goods or two bads. You know, you told me you wanted me to be honest, you told me you wanted me to be compassionate. What happens when those two clash? How do I honestly respond to her, given what I'm thinking or seeing, without hurting her feelings? Adults can help kids think about how they, the adults, deal with these issues in the real world. You don't need to read Kant for that. So the first is modeling. Second is to... Here comes an expression I love. I borrowed it from Mel Noddings, formerly of Stanford University. Attribute to children the best possible motive consistent with the facts. If you don't know why a child did something, and we often don't assume the worst, that the child was definitely cheating. If you don't know that the child was trying to be a nuisance or just doing it for attention, I hate that expression. And the late Herb Lovett, you see, who dealt with special needs and moving beyond behaviorism, and special needs kids used to say, just doing it for attention, that's like saying, oh, you just went out to dinner with your friends because of your need for companionship. With kids, we pathologize it. There's something wrong about it. Understand that a lot of times if kids do something wrong, it's because it's accidental or because they don't have the skills yet to express their frustration in more acceptable ways and so on. Number three, explain the rationale. for the things we're asking them to do. If you're asking kids to do something or telling them they can't do something, you owe them a reason. And the best kind of reason is to help them focus on how their actions affect somebody else. If you use consequences, then your focus is on how their actions affect themselves. And they start asking, what do they want me to do, and what happens to me if I don't do it? The flip side of that is a reward or positive reinforcement approach, where they get to ask, what do they want me to do, and what do I get for doing it? Maybe it's a sticker. Maybe it's some candy. Maybe it's a special privilege. Maybe it's just a patronizing pat on the head with, good job. That knee jerk, good job, good job, good job. This is not feedback. This is not encouragement. This is a judgment. Praise is about evaluating kids, telling them they've lived up to our standards. That's not what helps kids to become moral thinkers or caring people. It's what leads them to become dependent on an external evaluation. No wonder the research finds that kids bathed in positive reinforcement become more self-centered. That's built into rewards and punishments. They're about self-interest. What could we do instead? This kid over here gave half a sandwich to another kid at lunch in the cafeteria. I happened to see this. Am I pleased? Not necessarily, because all I saw was a behavior. I don't know why she did. That kid over there did the same thing. It turned out he did it for totally different reasons. I happen to know the reasons because I made up the hotel. She helped somebody else, hoping that an adult would capture being good. Catch the kid being good. You don't get more disrespectful than that, folks, being caught. Anyway. She did, hoping I would notice her, and then, you know, say, oh, that's a lovely, good job with sharing. You're such a nice person. I really like the way you felt there. This kid way over here, I was older than her, but then all the rest of my time would be lost. Sure enough, she gave half her sandwich to somebody else without knowing or caring whether an adult spotted her. You know why? But she saw the other kids, that was kind of like, just had enough to eat. That's it.
Which of these motives for helping
is more exciting to you? Do you want to see kids commit to? Now, that's the second question. Which of these two motives is likely to be strengthened by praise? You get it? If reinforcement has a lasting effect, the effect is exactly the opposite of what we're looking for. But what can we do instead? Well, maybe we can just shut up. Because in my experience, people who praise do so because they have to say it, not because the kids have to hear it. And boy, is it time to rethink our practices whenever that's true. More on this little topic, by the way. If you don't want to read a whole book, I've got a whole bunch of articles on my website, including one called Five Reasons to Stop Saying Good Job, and a bunch of others that deal with related issues having to do with caring and discipline and so on. My website is just my name, Alfie Kohn, ALFIEKOHN.org. What else could we, first of all, we could say nothing. The people who feel like I've got to give her some positive reinforcement are often people who believe in original sin or some secular variant thereof. Why? Because they tend to assume that if a kid helped, it must have been a fluke. That's why you need to reinforce it! Because it's unnatural and atypical. So the people who are always going around with a big smiley face, good job, high five, way to go, are typically people who have a dark, cynical view of children. The people who have a really, I was in a school once where I saw a sign on the board that said, only positive attitudes permitted beyond this point. You know, again, the smiley face attitude, I thought, wow, why don't you just put up a sign that says, My mental health is so precarious, you have to pretend you're in good mood. Folks, you can sweep the anger and depression under the carpet, but people just trip on it then, you know? So one thing you could say is nothing, because you don't need to. You can just watch. But another possibility is you might say, look at Rachel's mouth there with the crumbs on her lips. You gave her some... She looks pretty happy because she shared a cookie with you, don't you think? That's not, I like the way you ... That's, let me gently explain and describe what I see to help you attend to the impact of your action on somebody else so that you can then construct a sense of yourself as somebody who wants to help rather than doing it to get my approval. Let alone some tangible reward. That's a different kind of explanation. Kids have to construct meaning of helping. I don't know how many teachers I have found who do this amazing stuff in academics, realizing that you don't just impart information to kids about mathematical truths. Kids don't learn to be mathematical thinkers by copying the technique for borrowing from the tens place, or regrouping the variables, and then having 50 more problems just like it. That's why so many kids don't understand math and grow up into adults who cheerfully say, well, I was never good at math. And how come you're not teaching my kid the way I was taught math? Anyone see the irony here? I'm not teaching the kids the way you were taught math because you're exhibit A of a failure in that program. That's why we don't have worksheets. That's why we don't have math textbooks except as reference sources. It's why we don't have practice homework in the best math classes, but that's another conference. Just as kids have to construct the meaning of place value for themselves, so they must construct for themselves and with each other the meaning of courage, of helping, of generosity, of honesty, and so on. That's why character education programs are more examples of the behaviorist approach that has failed us academically. You cannot transmit values to children. You cannot instill values in kids. They're not empty receptacles. They're active meaning makers with respect to social and moral development, just as they are with respect to intellectual development. Number four, you want to help them become caring, give them a chance to practice, to be helping people. Set up the classroom, set up the school, set up the family so they have responsibilities for other people. Don't just talk the language of self-esteem or taking responsibility for your own behavior. Set it up so kids are connected. That's why so many great schools have some kind of buddy system where older kids and younger kids spend time together on a regular basis with the older and younger kids going to the library together. Oh, I loved this book when I was your age. Going to assemblies and sitting together, going on field trips together. Now the older kid gets a chance to practice care, not just learn about it, and the younger kid gets to experience care by, of all things, another child. Give them a chance to take responsibility for animals, for younger siblings, and so on. And number five here, in terms of the basic ingredients for care, is kids tend to be more caring when they're cared about. Now, I can't make somebody a caring person who isn't already. That's clear. But the reality is that we don't always express that care in ways that make sense. You have to have your emotional needs met in order to be psychologically free enough to meet other people's emotional needs. Otherwise, those needs echo so loudly in your ears that it's always about you. And you can't hear other people's cries of distress. We all know grown-ups like that. How do we help parents and teachers together provide kids with that safety so they can take risks, be vulnerable, make mistakes, and grow? Well, to be a caring person as a teacher, first you have to be a person with them, not just a crisply competent capital T teacher who's in charge. There's a looseness, an informality, a humanness about the best teachers when you watch them at work. They don't speak in sort of clipped, frozen tones of children where the main point is, I'm in control. Nor do they tend to speak in the sort of saccharine tones at the younger grades where their pitch goes up and down the scale. Are you ready to read this book now, my dear? There will. If you care about them, of course you care about them. You let them know in various ways. Jack, didn't you say on Friday that your mom was going to take you to the zoo? Did you do that? How'd it go? Was it fun? Remembering details about their lives, having lunch with them, responding to their journal entries, having a connection. There's one more little twist to this. Caring about kids is not enough. You have to care about them unconditionally. You have to let them know that they matter to you even when they fall short or screw up. Maybe that's when they need most to hear from you. The last thing they need is to be exiled from the meeting or from the classroom or from the school when they're in trouble. Sometimes we give kids timeouts or send them away when they're acting up, thinking, well, I've got to think about the other kids. But you're sending a message to the other kids, too, that you're a member of this community only conditionally. Screw up and you are out of here. That's why traditional discipline, including things like timeout and suspensions, make the whole place feel unsafe, even for the kids who are not troublemakers. And again, it's that temporary compliance in the sense that I'm in control. Marilyn Watson wrote a terrific book a couple of years ago called Learning to Trust, in which she explained that teachers can make it clear to students that certain actions are unacceptable while still providing, quote, a very deep kind of reassurance. The reassurance that she still cares about them and isn't going to punish or desert them even if they do something very bad. This, she says, allows students' best motives to surface, giving them space and support to reflect and engage in the moral act of restitution. In fact, she quotes one teacher she worked with as saying to a really challenging boy, you know what? I really, really like you. You can keep doing all this stuff and it's not going to change my mind. It seems like you're trying to get me to dislike you, but it's not going to work. I'm not ever going to do that. And she said, I can't prove it, but shortly after that, things started to get better. When kids really push our buttons, they're not testing limits. God, I hate that phrase. Testing limits is a way of framing the issue to justify imposing more limits, and sometimes even punishment. If kids are testing something when they act up, it's probably the unconditionality of our care. They're saying to us, if I do that, then I'll bet you'll stop liking me. And we have to give them the message, never, never, never. And that helps them to live up. There must be no strings attached on our care, because caring that has to be earned isn't really caring at all. Imagine that your students were asked, years after they left you, do they agree or disagree with the following statement? Even when I wasn't proud of how I acted, even when I didn't do the homework, even when I got low test scores or didn't seem interested in what was being taught, I knew that, insert your name here, still cared about me. What are you doing every day to make sure that all your kids will answer that the way you would hope? In the few minutes that remain, I want to emphasize that all of the things I've talked about here are necessary but not sufficient. Being a caring person who explains and models and attributes the best possible motives to them is important, but ultimately we have to be engaged in thinking about changing structures It is as important to see the negative as the positive. And what I mean by that is we have to understand the practices and policies that get in the way of caring.
Even if we do all the good stuff, we're not going to turn out the advantages I mentioned at the beginning until we figure out together and separately how we can move away from the bad stuff. Examples, and here's where it gets a little more controversial. If I had more time with you, I would ask you again to turn to somebody else and ask this question. What destroys caring communities in schools? It's a great activity to bring back to your colleagues. Going it through the back door. If we wanted to undermine a sense of belonging and safety and care in a school, what would we do? Here are some of the answers I've gotten from teachers when I've asked them to do this before. First, if you wanted to undermine caring, you would make sure you segregate kids by alleged ability a lot. You would pull kids out who seem to have less trouble than other kids at doing academic tasks and call them gifted in some respects and give them the kind of education that all kids would benefit from. And you would take other kids who have special needs and challenges and spend a lot of time isolating and segregating and thereby stratifying and stigmatizing your student body. That would be a good way to undermine a caring community. Second, you would set up large classes, large schools, and short periods of time, especially in high school, so that a given high school teacher has more than 100 kids, sometimes 200 kids, over the course of the day, all but guaranteeing the inability to develop the kind of caring relationships with kids that help them become caring people. You would set up a structure based on mid-19th century Prussia, which is where a lot of the stuff came from, to preclude meaningful interaction. Third, you would not only give grades, but you would emphasize grades a lot, thereby making sure that kids have a motive not to say help when they need it, but to pretend they have everything under control and to respond to you as follows. There are few things more destructive to quality education than a bunch of people trying to suck up to the teacher so they'll get a good grade. That's not a flaw in the teacher. That's not a flaw in the kid. That's a flaw in the use of grades. That's why the best schools I visit in North America do not give letter or number grades. They use authentic assessment because they want excellence and they want caring. Because caring is another victim. The effects on the relationship among kids is even more appalling than the effect on the relationship between kids and adults. If you have to give grades for now in a school, your job is to do everything possible to help kids forget about those grades as long as possible. If you have to give them a grade at the end of the term, never put a letter or number on any given assignment. Only comments. Only a conference, which is even better than comments, or a narrative, because at least there's a theoretical possibility of a dialogue. But never, never a letter or number. Otherwise, you're pushing grades into their face, making it more salient and undermining the very things you're trying to promote. The next thing you would do if you were trying to undermine caring, and this comes when I do this activity with teachers, how can we destroy caring, my little perverse professional development activity. One of the first ones that always comes up is if you want to undermine caring, you would have kids compete. You would set up competitive games in the classroom, not cooperative games. You would make a big deal. You would have things on the wall where kids are ranked in some respects. You would say, okay, which row is going to be the first to be dismissed? You might even say, I like the way Patricia is sitting so nice and quiet and ready. See, I like the way is problematic in its own right for reasons I've already gotten. That's about scrambling to get adult approval. But saying it in public is not about encouraging kids, it's about getting order. And it's also a lie. You don't like the way, dot, dot, dot. You're saying, rush to obey me and I'll single one of you out as an example in front of your peers. It's destructive at so many different levels. Research has found for more than 40 years that when kids are put in any kind of competitive situation, spelling bees, awards assemblies, competitive sports, that kids become less, several, I'll be specific about this, this isn't stuff I made up in the shower this morning. When kids compete, they tend to become less likely to imagine how the world looks from someone else's point of view. Psychologists call that perspective taking. Kids become less sensitive to each other's needs, less likely to communicate openly, less trusting. It's rational. Why would I trust you if your success will come at the expense of my failure? That's what competition is all about. And finally, less likely to help kids, other kids, when they need it. The research shows quite clearly, any kind of competition not only has a detrimental effect on excellence, which is really surprising and beyond the scope of this talk, not only has a detrimental effect on intrinsic motivation to learn, because now they're just doing it for the trophy, the certificate, the plaque, the recognition. It has a, not only has a detrimental effect on self-esteem, which it does. Competition is to self-esteem as sugar is to teeth, according to the research. But most disturbingly, competition of any kind of contest, leads kids to conclude that other people are potential obstacles to my success. You can kiss a caring community goodbye. In fact, one study even found that you can predict how ungenerous a child is just from knowing how competitive the parent is. Isn't that fascinating? You don't even have to make the kid compete. Just being around someone who's competitive is enough to have a detrimental effect on care. It's like living with secondhand smoke. So one of the most powerful things you can do to create a caring community isn't just the stuff you do to set it up. It's what you do to minimize or eliminate any example where I can succeed only if you fail. Very quickly, other things that get in the way that people tell me include traditional discipline. Rewards and punishments. They have a dual effect. On the one hand, rewards and punishments undermine that sense of care because now it's about what am I going to get, the reward, or what punishment will I avoid? So you're not promoting a caring community if you're using bribes and threats and typical classroom management to control kids. But at the same time, traditional discipline undermines that unconditionality. Timeouts for young kids are filed in the literature of psychology under love withdrawal. Because what you're saying to kids is, you can only be a member of this community if you jump through my hoops. That's the opposite of what kids need to flourish. And the flip side of that is positive reinforcement. You tried to unpack that 45 minutes ago. Why might it be the case that rewards make kids less generous, but to whatever you came up with, I will now add, good job is the perfect example of conditional teaching or parenting, of saying, only when you do what I approve of, when you impress me or please me or obey me, do you get that big smile from me. So kids learn, I'm only good when I please this person. And when they feel that sense of shakiness, that conditional acceptance of themselves, they tend to become less caring people with respect to others. The final barrier to caring, and I realize I've thrown a lot of stuff out in a very few minutes, much of which is quite controversial, The final barrier is the one I began with, why this whole conference is subversive. If you really wanted to undermine caring, you would have a government that is mostly concerned about corporate-style accountability and quantifiable academic data in the form of standardized testing. Because A, that changes what we value. How do you value the whole child and promote caring when you have pressure from above just to raise scores on bad tests? B, it changes whom we value. And there's a really ugly thing going on all over North America and beyond now as a direct result of this standardized testing mania, this accountability fad, as I think it will eventually be viewed, is that now we give messages out to kids that we value those who are really good at taking the test. And those who we once saw, in the best sense of the word, as a challenge to educate, are now seen as a problem. And in some schools, they're even pushed out so they don't bring down the scores. But it's not just the low-scoring kids whom we come to devalue in this awful climate. All the kids, whether they score well or not, whether they do their assignments or don't, all the kids get the message of conditionality. I'm cared about only to the extent, a moment ago I said, I behave the way the teacher wants me to. Now we can add, only to the extent I succeed. Oh, it's a double-barreled assault. Conditional based on how they do, and conditional based on how well they act. Our own elevation of abstractions like achievement and excellence can sometimes be a problem if we elevate those beyond flesh and blood real children and what they need. Take any one piece of this. Talk to your colleagues. How many of you are here with colleagues from a school? I hope those of you who are alone will go back and talk about this stuff when you get home, but I hope through the day, as you listen to many other speakers and are part of different workshops, you might also take one or two pieces out of this, something that made you feel, aha, now I get it, or who the hell is he? You made me mad. Something that makes you curious, something that makes you excited, something that makes you angry. Either what can we do more of to promote caring, or what do we have to work on structurally, not just individually, that gets in the way of caring? There are very few people in this gymnasium who are doing it all the great stuff all the time. Not me, that's for sure. And then there are very few other people who are doing it all wrong. Most of us are in the middle. Some of really warm, empathic people are still doing the good job thing constantly because no one ever invited them to reflect on that. Even people who desperately want kids to be critics of an oppressive society are nevertheless excluding kids from having much say about what's going on. In so many respects, our schools get it some of the way, but not the other way. We're still talking too much about test scores, even in our own classes, at the same time that we're talking about the whole child. A lot of us basically are giving with one hand and taking it away with the other. We want to be consistent in the right direction, that in all respects possible, with the help and care of our colleagues, we are thinking about the real kids as they matter and helping them to become genuinely good people.
Now, a change of pace before our second hour, in which we'll be looking at money and targets as motivators. This humorous piece from The Onion contains what I think is an essential realization. How much of what goes on in the Western world is needlessly competitive and motivated by money? Washington. The U.S. economy ceased to function this week after unexpected existential remark by Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke shocked Americans into realizing that money is, in fact, just a meaningless and intangible social construct. What began as a routine report before the Senate Finance Committee Tuesday ended with Bernanke passionately disavowing the entire concept of currency and negating in an instant the very foundation of the world's largest economy. Though raising interest rates is unlikely at the moment, the Fed will, of course, act appropriately if we, said Bernanke, who then paused for a moment, looked down at his prepared statement, shook his head in utter disbelief. You know what? It doesn't matter. None of this so-called money really matters at all. It's just an illusion, a wide-eyed Bernanke added as he removed bills from his wallet, slowly spread them out before him. Look at it. Meaningless pieces of paper with numbers printed on them. Worthless. According to witnesses, Senate Finance Committee members sat in thunderstruck silence for several moments until Senator Orrin Hatch finally shouted out, Oh my God, he's right! It's all a mirage! All of it! The money, our whole economy, it's all a lie! Screams then filled the Senate chamber as lawmakers and members of the press ran for the exits, leaving in their wake aisles littered with remains of torn currency. As news of the nation's collectively held delusion spread, the economy ground to a halt, with dumbfounded citizens everywhere walking out of their jobs as they contemplated the little green drawings of buildings and dead white men they once used to measure their adequacy and importance as human beings. At the New York Stock Exchange, Wednesday morning's opening bell echoed across a silent floor as the few traders who arrived for work out of habit looked up blankly at the meaningless scrolling numbers of the flashing screens above. I've spent 25 years of my life in this room yelling, Buy! Buy! Sell! Sell! And for what? Long-time trader Michael Palermo said. All I've done is move arbitrary designations of wealth from one column to another, wasting my life chasing this unattainable hallucination of wealth. What a cruel cosmic joke, he added. I'm going home to hug my daughter. Sources at the White House said President Obama was still trying to get his head round all this, and was in seclusion with his coin collection, muttering, It's just metal! It's just metal! Over and over again. The President will be making a statement very soon, Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told reporters. At the moment, though, his mind is just too blown to comment. A few U.S. banks have remained open, though most teller windows are unmanned due to lack of interest in transactions involving mere scraps of paper, or, worse, decimal points and computer data, signifying mere scraps of paper. At a Bank of America branch in Spokane, curious former customers wandered aimlessly through a large empty vault, while several would-be robbers of Chase Bank in Columbus, Ohio, reportedly put down their guns and exited the building hand in hand with security guards, laughing over the apparent absurdity of the idea of $100 bills. Likewise, the real estate industry has all but vanished, with mortgage lenders seeing no reason to stop people from reclaiming their foreclosed upon home.
I don't know what we were thinking in the first place, said former banker Nathan Collins of Brandon, as he jimmied open a door to allow a single mother and her 5 children back into their house. A bunch of people sign a bunch of papers, and now this family has no place to live? That's just plain ludicrous!
The realization that money is nothing more than an elaborate head game seems to have penetrated the entire country. In Wilmington, for instance, a collection agent reportedly broke down in joyful sobs when he informed a woman on the other end of the phone that he had absolutely no reason to harass her any more, as her Discover card debt was no longer comprehensible. For some Americans, the fog of disbelief surrounding the nation's epiphany has begun to lift, with many building new lives free from the illusion of money. It's back to the basics for me, Bernard Polk of Waverly said. I'm going to till the soil for my own sustenance and get anything else I need by bartering. If I want milk, I'll pay for it in tomatoes. If I need a new hoe, I'll pay for it in lettuce.